My Position, originally given as a talk to a Caius College audience in May 1992. This talk is not about whether I believe in God. Instead, I'll discuss my approach to how one can understand the universe. What is the status and meaning of a grand unified theory, a theory of everything? There is a real problem here. People who ought to study and argue such questions, the philosophers, have mostly not had enough mathematical background to keep up with modern developments in theoretical physics. There is a subspecies called philosophers of science who ought to be better equipped, but many of them are failed physicists who found it too hard to invent new theories and so took to writing about the philosophy of physics instead. They're still arguing about the scientific theories of the early years of this century, like relativity and quantum mechanics. They're not in touch with the present frontier of physics. Maybe I'm being a bit harsh on philosophers, but they've not been very kind to me. My approach has been described as naive and simple-minded. I've been variously called a nominalist, an instrumentalist, a positivist, a realist, and several other ists. The technique seems to be refutation by denigration. If you can attach a label to my approach, you don't have to say what is wrong with it. Surely everyone knows the fatal errors of all those isms. The people who actually make the advances in theoretical physics don't think in the categories that the philosophers and historians of science subsequently invent for them. I'm sure that Einstein, Heisenberg, and Dirac didn't worry about whether they were realists or instrumentalists. They were simply concerned that the existing theories didn't fit together. In theoretical physics, the search for logical self-consistency has always been more important in making advances than experimental results. Otherwise elegant and beautiful theories have been rejected because they don't agree with observation. But I don't know of any major theory that has been advanced just on the basis of experiment. The theory always came first, put forward from the desire to have an elegant and consistent mathematical model. The theory then makes predictions, which can then be tested by observation. If the observations agree with the predictions, that doesn't prove the theory. But the theory survives to make further predictions, which again are tested against observation. If the observations don't agree with the predictions, one abandons the theory. Or rather, that is what is supposed to happen. In practice, people are very reluctant to give up a theory in which they've invested a lot of time and effort. They usually start by questioning the accuracy of the observations. If that fails, they try to modify the theory in an ad hoc manner. Eventually, the theory becomes a creaking and ugly edifice. Then someone suggests a new theory, in which all the awkward observations are explained in an elegant and natural manner. An example of this was the Michelson-Morley experiment performed in 1887, which showed that the speed of light was always the same, no matter how the source or the observer were moving. This seemed ridiculous. Surely someone moving toward the light ought to measure it traveling at a higher speed than someone moving in the same direction as the light. Yet the experiment showed that both observers would measure exactly the same speed. For the next 18 years, people like Hendrik Lorentz and George Fitzgerald tried to accommodate this observation within accepted ideas of space and time. They introduced ad hoc postulates, such as proposing that objects got shorter when they moved at high speeds. The entire framework of physics became clumsy and ugly. Then, in 1905, Einstein suggested a much more attractive viewpoint, in which time was not regarded as completely separate and on its own. Instead, it was combined with space in a four-dimensional object called space-time. Einstein was driven to this idea not so much by the experimental results as by the desire to make two parts of the theory fit together in a consistent whole. The two parts were the laws that govern the electric and magnetic fields and the laws that govern the motion of bodies. I don't think Einstein or anyone else in 1905 realized how simple and elegant the new theory of relativity was. It completely revolutionized our notions of space and time. This example illustrates well the difficulty of being a realist in the philosophy of science, for what we regard as reality is conditioned by the theory to which we subscribe. I'm certain that Lorentz and Fitzgerald regarded themselves as realists, interpreting the experiment on the speed of light in terms of Newtonian ideas of absolute space and absolute time. These notions of space and time seem to correspond to common sense and reality. Yet, nowadays, those who are familiar with the theory of relativity, still a disturbingly small minority, have a rather different view. We ought to be telling people about the modern understanding of such basic concepts as space and time. If what we regard as real depends on our theory, how can we make reality the basis of our philosophy? I would say that I'm a realist, in the sense that I think there is a universe out there waiting to be investigated and understood. I regard the solipsist position that everything is the creation of our imaginations as a waste of time. No one acts on that basis. But we cannot distinguish what is real about the universe without a theory. I, therefore, take the view, which has been described as simple-minded or naive, that a theory of physics is just a mathematical model that we use to describe the results of observations. A theory is a good theory if it is an elegant model, if it describes a wide class of observations, and if it predicts the results of new observations. Beyond that, it makes no sense to ask if it corresponds to reality, because we do not know what reality is, independent of a theory. This view of scientific theories may make me an instrumentalist or a positivist. As I've said before, I've been called both. The person who called me a positivist went on to add that everyone knew that positivism was out of date, another case of refutation by denigration. It may indeed be out of date, in that it was yesterday's intellectual fad, but the positivist position I've outlined seems the only possible one for someone who's seeking new laws and new ways to describe the universe. It's no good appealing to reality because we don't have a model independent concept of reality. In my opinion, the unspoken belief in a model independent reality is the underlying reason for the difficulties philosophers of science have with quantum mechanics and the uncertainty principle. There's a famous thought experiment called Schrödinger's cat. A cat is placed in a sealed box. There is a gun pointing at it, and it will go off if a radioactive nucleus decays. The probability of this happening is 50%. Today, no one would dare propose such a thing, even purely as a thought experiment, but in Schrödinger's time, they hadn't heard of animal liberation. If one opens the box, one will find the cat is either dead or alive. But before the box is opened, the quantum state of the cat will be a mixture of the dead cat state with the state in which the cat is alive. This, some philosophers of science find very hard to accept. The cat can't be half shot and half not shot, they claim, any more than one can be half pregnant. Their difficulty arises because they are implicitly using a classical concept of reality in which an object has a definite single history. The whole point of quantum mechanics is that it has a different view of reality. In this view, an object has not just a single history, but all possible histories. In most cases, the probability of having a particular history will cancel out with the probability of having a very slightly different history. But in certain cases, the probabilities of neighboring histories reinforce each other. It is one of these reinforced histories that we observe as the history of the object. In the case of Schrödinger's cat, there are two histories that are reinforced. In one, the cat is shot, while in the other, it remains alive. In quantum theory, both possibilities can exist together. But some philosophers get themselves tied in knots because they implicitly assume that the cat can have only one history. The nature of time is another example of an area in which our theories of physics determine our concept of reality. It used to be considered obvious that time flowed on forever, regardless of what was happening. But the theory of relativity combined time with space and said that both could be warped or distorted by the matter and energy in the universe. So our perception of the nature of time changed from being independent of the universe to being shaped by it. It then became conceivable that time might simply not be defined before a certain point. As one goes back in time, one might come to an insurmountable barrier, a singularity beyond which one could not go. If that were the case, it wouldn't make sense to ask who or what caused or created the Big Bang. To talk about causation or creation implicitly assumes there was a time before the Big Bang singularity. We've known for 25 years that Einstein's general theory of relativity predicts that time must have had a beginning in a singularity 15 billion years ago. But the philosophers have not yet caught up with the idea. They're still worrying about the foundations of quantum mechanics that were laid down 65 years ago. They don't realize that the frontier of physics has moved on. Even worse is the mathematical concept of imaginary time, in which Jim Hartle and I suggested the universe may not have any beginning or end. I was savagely attacked by a philosopher of science for talking about imaginary time. He said, "How can a mathematical trick like imaginary time have anything to do with the real universe?" I think this philosopher was confusing the technical mathematical terms, real and imaginary numbers, with the way that real and imaginary are used in everyday language. This just illustrates my point. How can we know what is real, independent of the theory or model with which to interpret it? I've used examples from relativity and quantum mechanics to show the problems one faces when one tries to make sense of the universe. It doesn't really matter if you don't understand relativity and quantum mechanics, or even if these theories are incorrect. What I hope I have demonstrated is that some sort of positivist approach, in which one regards a theory as a model, is the only way to understand the universe, at least for a theoretical physicist. I'm hopeful that we will find a consistent model that describes everything in the universe. If we do that, it will be a real triumph for the human race.